Welcome to the Bridging the Gap podcast. And you got me and Dave both back after some time away. Well, you had Dave back on Sunday, actually, preaching after his study leave. And I'm just back after a long weekend away. So we're both...
Were you in Centre Parks?
Centre Parks, yeah.
I told Rich and Pete and Johnny yesterday that you're in Centre Parks. And I was like, I think he is.
Got it right. Yeah, I saw photos of them out gallivanting. yeah, they had a lovely time. And Dave, what about you? So you had your week's study leave up in lovely Bala.
Yeah.
So how'd it go? Was it refreshing for you? Anything in particular you enjoyed reading while you were on study leave that you'd want to share about?
Yeah. I think the thing I enjoyed being in Bala in terms of just like a beautiful place, isn't it?
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And Aled and Garen's mum and dad, Gwydion and Catherine, looked after me. I feel like I probably learned more from them than my books, to be fair, just in terms of like the conversation. I think that one of the books in particular I enjoyed reading was one called Neither Poverty Nor Riches by Craig Bloomberg. It's sort of a biblical theology, sort of sketches out the big picture of the Bible about money and possessions. So it's based on, or the title of the book is based on, a verse in Proverbs 30. Two things I ask of you, Lord. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep falsehood and lies far from me. Give me neither property nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal and dishonor the name of the Lord. So in it, it sort of talks about how, you know, this verse might point us to being, you know, quote unquote, middle class, but the book goes on to highlight that most people reading the book would be middle-class Westerners who are actually in the top 80% of the world in terms of wealth. So you talk about how money's a good gift, can be used for many different things, and about, ultimately, it's about how money's a gift, you can't take it with you. There's a line out from Wesley, you know, save all you can, spend all you can, give all you can, and gift all you can. I was like, that's helpful because it encompasses all. Yeah. All those things, isn't it? It was a very challenging read, all in all.
It is a challenging thought, isn't it? We think of ourselves as being in the middle, and actually,
we're probably not.
We're not in world terms, we're not in the middle at all.
Yeah, and yeah, did a wee bit more reading for Hebrews in September.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, reread 12 Ways Your Phone Is Changing You.
Did you read it on your phone? Please tell me you read it on your phone.
No, I didn't.
I read mine on my phone. So ironic.
I borrowed the hard copy off Owen Davis, and well, it's funny. I sort of put some things into practice in terms of like turn off notifications and deleting unnecessary apps. But it made me realize, like last week I was in study leave, I didn't look at a single article or news or anything. So I had no idea what was going on in the world.
There's something quite nice about that, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, glad you're back, Dave. And you came straight back in and preached our last but one sermon on our short series in Genesis 1-3.
Yeah.
And you were looking at the curse that God pronounced, and I'm unpacking that for us.
Yeah.
Just taking a step back though, because of course Eve is tempted there by Satan in the form of the serpent. And I guess a question that arises in a lot of Christians' minds, maybe you've been asked this while we've been preaching through the series, can we know anything more about Satan and why he rebelled? You know, how does that happen in the first place?
Yeah. Because there's sort of stuff that Tom had touched on in the previous week as well. I think if you look, the little book of Jude and 2 Peter in the New Testament give us some clues about what happened. So Jude 1:6 says, the angels who did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of that great day. And then 2 Peter 2:4 says, God did not spare the angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell, and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment. So they're two pretty confusing and obscure passages in some ways, but it appears that there's once a host of holy angels, and some of them, including Satan, sinned, you know, did not stay in their position of authority, the verse says. So in other words, there's some sort of insurrection. They desired for more power or more authority than God had appointed them, or maybe they wanted to be God. So we don't really know. Those give us hints. I think ultimately we read those things and think, oh, that answers the question, but really just cause more questions, like how can they have done that in the presence of a holy God? So I think in summary, 1 Corinthians 13 is helpful here. You know, we know in part.
Yeah.
Like, so, or Deuteronomy 29:29, isn't it? You know, the secret things belong to the Lord. Yeah. So it's a mystery.
So we can only go for so far. So in terms of recap, you know, the angels, Satan included, part of God's good creation.
Yeah.
But at some point, there's that rebellion.
Yeah.
And we don't know the exact details of when and how.
Yeah.
And how that fits.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah, thought I'd start you with a nice, easy question there, Dave. So, talking a bit more about Satan, the serpent, why is the certainty of the serpent and his seed's defeat such good news? You mentioned how the seed of the serpent is anyone who's opposed to God. That's a lot of people. So, why is this good news that the serpent and his seed are defeated?
Yeah. So, I suppose, like, in the verse, it's a certainty that the devil will be defeated, but it does talk about the seed of the serpent. So that seems to be anyone who follows, who's against God. Mm. Like, there's sort of two ways to live, the Bible says. I think it's good news in the sense that we live in a world where sin and wickedness and injustice is rampant. So it's a good news that for the Christian that Christ defying the devil's sting at the cross. And one day, as we learned when we looked in Revelation, that he'll be no more, like his head will be crushed. So that is, that's really exciting that there'll be no more sin or sadness, no more turning on the news and despairing.
Yeah.
But it is hard to wrap our heads around, isn't it? That there's so many people who don't yet know Jesus or follow Jesus. So I suppose it's something to pray about, to be more active in our evangelism and to thank God for his mercy to us. Like, it should make us humble and not proud, shouldn't it? So whenever I struggle with that sort of, there's a lot of people who might be going to hell, I come back to Abraham in Genesis and think, you know, the judge of all the earth will do what is right. And that might seem slightly flippant, but I think otherwise I'd despair.
And as you're talking there, I'm thinking, and you mentioning doing reading on Hebrews, you know, it's not angels that he helps, the writer of the Hebrews says. It's human beings. Yeah. Christ became a human being to save human beings. This highlights the grace of God, doesn't it? That we're all the serpent seed in one sense by nature, but mercy is offered that isn't offered to fallen angels.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
Going back to the curse then, what does it mean that work isn't cursed? Surely work is cursed because it's harder now.
Yeah, we've said a couple of times, haven't we, Matt, that work isn't cursed. It's a good gift from God, and yet work is harder because of the consequences of the fall. So it's important that we see the goodness of work in God's original creation and then the struggle of work under the fall. So if we only see that work's really good, we'll be frustrated when things don't go the way they should. And then if we only see work is bad, then we'll have a hard time doing anything for the glory of God, won't we? So it's not all good and it's not all bad. It's part of God's good creation tainted by the fall, and God is at work to redeem work itself. So Romans 8:20-21 says this: the creation was subjected to frustration in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. So through us, God is after the renewal, is working out the renewal of creation. So grace doesn't just change, you know, where we're going, you know, our eternal destiny. It also changes our whole life and worldview now. So it's the basis for our living. So redemption affects every part of us, where we're going and where we are now. So for example, now God is glorified when we put ourselves, our whole selves, into our work with a view towards pleasing God and not man, which is seen in Colossians 3.
That's really helpful. It's the phrase that's sprung to mind as you were talking then is, people sometimes talk about the Protestant work ethic, don't they? And I think that's kind of been twisted to mean that if you're a Protestant, you're a workaholic. Whereas actually my understanding is, it means that the original Protestants, the reformers, the Puritans, said that all of life, all of work was ministry for the Lord, and that, and so you took all of work seriously and as a good thing for God's glory.
Absolutely.
So a question that might come in some people's minds, and they're reading this passage about the curse that God is handing down and the consequences of the fall. Are these punishments by God not heavy-handed? Is this not just overdoing it?
Yeah, we talked about this with the teenagers on Sunday after church, but part of what we, part of the way we sort of try to answer this question is that Often in sport, for example, we might question the umpire or referee's decisions because we question if they've interpreted or understood or judged the rules and laws correctly. So, well, that's up to interpretation, that especially in rugby where there's so much interpretation going on, we're saying, well, it's not fair, the line seems to be wiggly. Whereas thankfully with the Lord, he's the Lord, he's the rule giver, he's the keeper, he's the judge, he's the jury, he's the executioner, he's the one who takes the punishment ultimately. So it's not heavy handed because it's part of God's holiness. So part of God's holiness is that he's just and fair. So this question, you know, to pick up Paul's language in Romans is, you know, can the pot say to the potter, like, why are you making me this way? Like, whenever we struggle under the rules, it doesn't mean that we have the right to question the rule giver's heart. Yeah. Which Paul later says in Romans, doesn't he? Oh, the depths of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out. Like, whenever we look at rules and struggle with them, we should ultimately, I think, they should lead us to worship, shouldn't they?
Yes. And the flip side is, I'm glad you quoted that verse from Romans, you know, when we do, in my heart, when I might start to criticize God's punishments for being harsh, I'm saying I know better than God.
Yeah.
I'm more fair than God. I'm more just and more merciful than God. Mm. He is, as you say, he's the good creator. As we've been saying all the way through this series, we're made to live in God's will and God's way, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you see, bring it back to you, Dave, and making it quite pointed,
yeah,
how do you see in your own life, dare I say, ask it in your own marriage, the consequences of the fall? How does it work out in our lives?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you don't have to look far, do you? Even just the consequences of the fall is that our bodies are decaying, aren't they? So you get out of bed in the morning and you're creaking and you're like, oh, yep, that's because of the decay of my body. I'm returning to dust, aren't I? I think, you know, there's so many different ways, but in particular, I suppose whenever I consider the sort of stuff about, you know, the husband will rule over his wife, sort of highlighted on Sunday how that's like a harsh rule, I often just see myself being unfair, harsh, dismissive to Amy. And then I suppose that's why in the New Testament, in Paul and in Peter, it talks about husbands loving their wives and not being harsh to them and loving your wives as Christ loved the church. So I just see every single day how I'm feeling to do that. I suppose another consequence of the fall is just that, like, work is hard. On Sunday, whenever I came back, you know, from a time of study leave, I just had so many different questions or conversations or things that were like put back on my radar that I'd successfully shelved for a week. I was like, oh, working it is just hard. Like, it's both a delight and a duty, but often I find myself falling into the duty section, really.
Yeah. It keeps coming back to what we were talking about under the previous question, doesn't it? That work is good. Yeah. Work itself isn't an evil, cursed thing, yeah, but it becomes hard because of the fall, and we all experience that, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, to ask a bit more of a random question, so this is verse 18 of Genesis 3. Well, start with verse 17. Cursed is the ground because of you, that through painful toil you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. So, do these verses teach us there were no thorns before the fall?
Yeah.
What do you reckon, Dave?
Like, no idea in some ways. I found this by Thomas Watson quite helpful. So this, I'm going to read a long quote here, so hopefully
Go for it. Thomas Watson quote's brilliant.
Yeah. So he says, did the earth in innocence bear thorns, though they were afterwards threatened as a punishment? It is likely that it did bear thorns, that is, before the fall. For when God had was done creating, he made no new species or kinds of things. But the meaning is, now after sin, the earth should bring forth more plentifully of thorns, and now those thorns should be hurtful and choke the corn, which hurtful quality was not in them before. So I think what he seems to be saying there is that whenever God had finished creating, he was done, it was finished. He didn't say, okay, now the fall's happened, I will create you know, roses with thorns.
Yeah.
They always had thorns, but now they'll be plentiful. They'll be painful now. Like, we'll experience pain and agony from it.
Mm.
And they'll choke the corn. Like, they will, as maybe before the fall, they didn't choke and kill. Whereas now they will be harmful and a pest sort of thing. So,
yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because I was reading something prepping for a previous sermon about the fact that God, I can't remember which commentator it was, God planted the Garden of Eden for Adam to work. The garden was prepared and he just had to tend it.
Yeah.
And then, but then after the fall, Adam has to go out of Eden and he has to make the garden in the face of all that's happened as a result of the fall.
Yeah.
Good Thomas Watson quote. That's really helpful. Can you give us examples of how sin promises abundance? Because you mentioned this, promises abundance, instead delivers agony. What does that look like?
Yeah, once again, it was one of those phrases that I said, but probably could have done a lot more unpacking in some ways, because talk about how the devil, you know, promises abundance, divinity, and actually in the end, the outcome's dust. They die. So. Mm. That was sort of the context of that little quote. So there's so many examples. Like, people who have affairs, they think, oh, this is going to be a good thing. It's going to spice up my life. I'm going to, you know, this person understands me the way that my wife or my husband doesn't. And then whenever it all comes out, it delivers agony for you, for your family, for your kids. It doesn't deliver on its promises.
Yeah.
You know, there's plenty of other examples. You know, gluttony, we think, if I just eat loads of food, then I'll be satisfied. But then, you know, lo and behold, well, even, I mean, this is a really silly example, but whenever I've been having these hard things, the doctor said to you, we should lose some weight, because if you are heavy, you're more likely to have health issues.
Yeah.
And I sort of think, oh, like, food promises me great things, but then actually, the consequences are like, I can have issues and pain. So that, you know, those are two examples of, you know, I suppose someone might sit and listen and think, well, I'm not going to have an affair, but I think, well, I'm in particular guilty of gluttony often. I need to see that it too is a sin that needs to be killed.
You could almost sum this up, couldn't you, with a phrase? I think Sophia's, one of Sophia's friends this week in a message that did, you know, the buzz phrase, you do you. It kind of sums up where society's at, I guess, where society's always been at, really.
Yeah.
And you do you is about, do what you want to do, what fulfills you.
Yeah.
And it never satisfies, does it? It never pays off. That it promises so much, doesn't deliver.
Yeah.
I mean, talking about satisfaction, you close by talking about how Jesus only ultimately can satisfy, and three areas I think we mentioned: parenting, marriage, and work. How does Jesus satisfy in those three areas specifically then?
Yeah, I suppose in all those areas, the gospel just speaks into those different things, don't they? So whenever we think, if only I could be, you know, a better parent or have kids for myself, we're reminded that, well, one, in Christ we're adopted into the family of faith, which means we're being parented and cared for by the best father in the world. So actually, you don't have to be the best parent in the world, because God is a better parent to your child than you are, which is slightly crazy, isn't it? So it relieves you of that pressure. Whenever you think about marriage, whether you're happily married, unhappily married, or unhappily single, you know that there's a better wedding coming, and there's a better husband coming, because he's perfect and he give himself up for you. And then, you know, whenever you think about the area of work, it's what we'll see in Hebrews, isn't it? Like, Christ finished his work of salvation, sat down at the right hand of the throne of God, which means you can both rest in him, knowing that you don't have to, you know, strive to please, you know, work hard in order to earn your salvation, but also you can labor for him joyfully because of what he's already done for you. So
yeah.
Those are sort of three different areas, I'd say.
Oh, amen. What a place to finish, because this is where, and obviously we always want to finish there with Christ, don't we? And the series, pray for me as I'm prepping for this Sunday, because we're finishing with, you know, the garments of skin that Adam and Eve received, and what's that about? What does that point to? And of course, we all know where it's going to end up. Yeah. Quite rightly, it's going to end up pointing to Jesus, isn't it? And all that he has done. And this whole series is ultimately about him. Thanks, Dave.
I have to write life group notes for that, don't I?
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Get cracking.
That's on the to-do list today.
Look forward to seeing you all on Sunday, and we'll be finishing off our series then, and more from us again next week.
What are we doing next?
Thanks. So after Genesis, we're doing a short series on friendship. So Christian friendship, what that looks like. So it's going to be me, Dave, Graham Hunter, going to be doing a sermon each on that. And then we get into the summer halls, after which it's going to be our Hebrew series beginning. Yeah. So
in the summer, we're doing Psalms as well. Summer Psalms. Classic.
Yeah. Getting cocker on with that. Been there before. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So that's the plan, God willing, for the coming months. Nice. Yeah. See you Sunday.
Bye.